Amina is an activist during the Arab Spring. Her blog, Gay Girl in Damascus, attracts readers from around the world. When she's mysteriously abducted, her followers mobilize, desperate to save her. What they find shocks them. I'm Samira Moyeddin, the host of Gay Girl Gone, a new 6-part series from CBC. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm El Amin Abdul-Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
Rosie, I want to talk about routines this week, namely routines that are changing. For example, I still don't have a haircut, so that hasn't changed. But one thing that is beginning to change is, remember when you see the Prime Minister standing outside of his house speaking every single day? It's not happening as much anymore. When it does happen, are we getting the same thing out of it, or has something shifted in that?
I do know about him standing outside of the house. In fact, have many things to say, but I also have a lot of questions about temporary foreign workers in this country, particularly seasonal workers on farms. That we now have a third migrant worker in Ontario who has died of COVID-19, and it's raising lots of questions about their working and living conditions, a problem that was there before the pandemic and might be thereafter. So I want to talk about that too.
Lots to chat about.
Let's do it.
Let's go.
Well, this week we are in, week 15 since the country began kind of shutting down. And in that period of time, we've seen the Prime Minister handle COVID by, among other strategies, appearing every day for a press conference, or at least at the start it was every day. He's done something like 80 press conferences in 106 days. Those pressers have been used to, announce very serious things. First, it was the size of the threat that we're all facing, and then all these public health messages about speaking moistly or not, and then the big sort of policy announcements, the CERB, the wage subsidy, the funding for vaccine research, border closures. They all happen in these pressers, and they happen, nearly every day. And they continue to happen, revealing only the important stuff, right? Like, for example, what we heard earlier this week.
Today, I can announce that our government is contributing almost $100 million for the new Merit Functional Foods location in Winnipeg. This facility will be a world leader in plant-based proteins and will create good jobs in a fast-growing field.
All right, let me just get on the record and say I'm all in on plant-based burgers and what have you, and I'm relieved that they're here. But having said that, you'd think that 15 weeks into this thing, maybe we can make the call that these pressers are maybe running out of news to break, and the government defends them on the basis of accountability. But it is possible that they've run their course.
I also am pro a plant-based burger or a hot dog.
Yes.
And I'm pro Winnipeg. So, all good. But I will admit on Monday when I heard that announcement, I sort of went, wah, wah, here we are scraping the barrel a little bit. This has nothing to do with the pandemic. It doesn't have anything to do with systemic racism. It doesn't have anything to do with anything that is particularly pressing other than barbecue season. So I also felt on Monday that it was a little strange. The questions and answers on Monday were, of course, more substantive. But out of those, if the Prime Minister has done 80 press conferences, I've probably done 77 of them. I took a couple days off. So I lived all of them. And I do know that certainly at the beginning, that regular time slot of 11 a.m. seeing the Prime Minister come out of his home, which, remember, he originally did because his wife tested positive for COVID-19. So he was in isolation. That they did become really important listening moments for Canadians. And I know that because I heard from so many of them. People stuck at home, uncertain about the future, scared, wanting to know how the government would help them. These became sort of moments where they would check in online or on TV. And certainly the ratings reflected that. CBC says that their average weekly reach at the beginning was close to 5 million TV viewers. That's just TV, not streaming. 2.3 million people listened on the radio, which, is also huge. So they were hugely important for Canadians and really important for Canadians to hear from the Prime Minister, I think, at the beginning.
Yeah.
but it's where we are now that I understand that you want to talk more about.
Yes. Yeah, like, listen, I very easily can recognize the importance and the validity of doing these things, especially at the start. But if you start doing them, it's very hard to get out of the habit because if for no other reason, it might just send the message that, you know, everything is fine now because the prime minister is not appearing every day. And it's a time when you kind of need the most vigilance possible from people. Mm-hmm. The fact that millions of people started watching in the first few weeks tells you that maybe you should return to those people and keep them updated on everything that's happening. But we also can't really ignore the political dimension of what's happening here. The Abacus polling numbers tell the story of the liberals and conservatives being – they were 1 point apart in mid-March. And from there on, the graph just shoots up for the liberals all the way up. They now sit at 40 points, 11 points above the conservatives. And these are June numbers. Like, these are like pretty current numbers. They're from this week. There are people who have gotten used to seeing the PM every day for 3 months. And there are a lot of good policy reasons to keep doing these pressers. But there are great political reasons to do these pressers. And I think that is sort of what's troubling some opposition members who pointed out that this is basically free ad space for the prime minister to roll out things that are not really, you know, about the pandemic.
Or are not really as pressing. I mean, my producer, Phil, counted up also all the questions that – or around the number of questions that the prime minister has taken. So about 900 questions during this period. And obviously, journalists are not, timid in asking questions and are asking mm-hmm. tough questions. There is, however, a difference between journalists doing a job of accountability and trying to get the government to explain things and the opposition parties being afforded the ability to do that inside the House of Commons, which has been severely limited since the election, even since last summer. I mean, I think that they have sat somewhere in the vicinity of, 30-something sittings of a regular House of Commons, as well as mm-hmm. these COVID committees. So, I think it is, yes, important to speak to Canadians, yes, important to take questions from journalists, but there's also, as part of democracy, an important need for opposition parties to be able to ask their own questions and push their own issues in committees, parliamentary committees, and elsewhere. But of course, there's a political component to this. At one point, we at the CBC decided that we weren't going to put the prime minister on CBC, the main network, anymore. He was only mm-hmm. going to be on News Network, which was free for Canadians for that period of time as well. Well, that was quickly noticed by the prime right. minister's office that we had made that shift. But it was because we also saw the lack of urgency in some of the things that he was saying. And we also were concerned by what you were saying there, that this was becoming, more of an electioneering tool rather than a public service tool.
Right.
Winston Churchill said, never let a good crisis go to waste. And that's a horribly cynical thing to say at a time during a pandemic, but it's also horribly accurate.
I mean, totally. And Winston Churchill then went on to lose an election after the war. So maybe he didn't make the best use of these crises. There's a real political fatigue that ends up setting in. And if you end up associating the prime minister with the pandemic, with seeing his face every single day, there is actually I imagine there's a political risk that comes with that, too.
Sure.
Now, in the last 3 months, there have been billions and billions and billions of dollars spent. The Liberals have been relatively open about where that money's going. But like you said, the questions that he's asked in the daily pressers are just not the same flavor that he would get in the House from the opposition. Do you think the opposition have a point in being critical of the media for airing these pressers?
Well, obviously, I'm going to say no. and I'm going to say no because we have, I think the media has adjusted as time has gone on. And for instance, the prime minister has started doing these events on Fridays where he takes his show on the road. It's the beginning of them trying to get back, with Canadians into places as much as they can, where he sort of is advertising or promoting programs that the government has put in place. Well, that's great, but that's not something that we need to be, building TV programming or radio programming around, as my boss, the parliamentary bureau chief here says, if everything's special, nothing is special. Mm-hmm. So, I think that if you don't take the Prime Minister's comments, at very least his questions and answers, you are doing a disservice to Canadians by trying to get more information. But if you take it relentlessly and without a filter, then you are doing a disservice to, you know, the other Canadians that don't think that that's necessary. I guess my question would be, do they now realize that there is a little bit of fatigue? Because it is Wednesday, we've recorded this. So far, he's only done one press conference outside of his home. That was on Monday. He's probably going to do one on Thursday when this drops. But that's sort of it. So do they, too, realize the political urgency is gone and the risks that you're talking about remain?
Hey friends, I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud. I'm the host of the new podcast, Commotion. If you don't know about us yet, well, we are your daily deep dive into the biggest stories coming out of the world of pop culture, art, and entertainment. And luckily, I'm not going to be doing it alone, okay? I'll be joined by some brilliant culture writers and thoughtful superfans. We're going to have hilarious hot takes. We're going to have vibrant debates. Consider this your invitation to join the group chat. Get in here and join us. Commotion, available weekdays on CBC Listen.
Again, this week, I want to talk about one of those issues where the pandemic has sort of exposed vulnerabilities in society or people that are extra vulnerable in moments like these. And you know, subjects that certainly advocates and people have been talking about for a long time, but maybe not the rest of us. And so it has now forced things into the spotlight and perhaps will lead to change. And this is the case of temporary foreign workers in this country. It comes after now a third migrant worker died in southern Ontario of COVID-19. This gentleman's name, Juan Lopez Chaparro, he had been coming to Canada for many, many years to do this agriculture work. The two other gentlemen that also died were also from Mexico, all three of them from Mexico. Mr. Chaparro leaves behind a wife and four children, and it is the case for the other two gentlemen as well, that they leave behind families, and they come here to do this work and are many times the sole breadwinners in the families, and then they return to Mexico with the money they've made. As it turns out, Canada relies a lot on these short-term foreign workers. There's about 60,000 a year that come from largely from Latin America, some from the Caribbean. And when the pandemic first happened, the government did put in place some rules around these workers coming because they are so vital to our agriculture system, to our meat processing plants, all those different things. And they gave $50 million to these companies to make sure that the workers could quarantine safely for 14 days when they arrived, so that then, you know, they were presumably COVID-free and could go into these plants or into the fields and greenhouses and do the work. But what we have seen is that clearly that wasn't enough, and clearly these workers were not being protected and treated the same as you would expect workers in Canada to be treated. It's a very, you know, it's a very sad story, and it's unfortunately another problem that COVID-19 has really exposed to the rest of us.
So when these outbreaks happen in farms, part of the reason it's so dangerous is that it's so many people living together and often cramped accommodations, and some of them are in just horrific sanitary conditions. In one farm, the Scotland Group Farm, about 199 of 216 temporary foreign workers who work there have tested positive for COVID-19. 199 out of 216. I saw the Toronto Star reported this week that just between 2016 and 2018, Mexican authorities received about 33 complaints about Scotland farms, and that's like more than any other Canadian farm during that period of time. Hmm. And those reports for anything from bunkhouse floods to pest infestations to broken amenities. And the fact that these complaints have existed before, the fact that, as you mentioned, advocates have talked about for decades about the conditions that these workers exist in, it must feel so agonizing for those people to have finally have a platform to say, we have said all these problems for years, And now everyone's listening, but like, at what cost after so many people got sick?
And it probably isn't surprising. Like, we shouldn't be too surprised because the Public Health Agency of Canada has said from the beginning it's these congregate living situations that are so high risk. It was the meat plants in Alberta. We saw that was the biggest outbreak in Canada. And it is also at these greenhouses or farms in southwestern and southern Ontario, where the vast majority of workers go. But certainly they go all across the country. What is also upsetting here is that the Mexican government then, after the death of two of their citizens, said, well, we're going to suspend the agreement with Canada because we're very concerned about this. Mexico and Canada have a formal agreement that allows Mexican workers to come to Canada to fill in parts of the labor market where either there aren't enough Canadians to do the work or Canadians don't want to do the work. And so Mexicans come here to fill in some of those holes, and it's a formal arrangement the two countries have. Canada then went to Mexico and said, well, here are some of the things we can do to try and make this better. We'll try to do better assessments of farms. We'll try to do increased inspections. We'll reach out to employers to make sure that the rules are being followed. But as it turns out, because of the pandemic, these inspections have largely been done virtually. Does that sound familiar? Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Because that's what was happening in some long-term care centers too. And so even with the federal government's reassurances, and they were enough to allow Mexico to then say, okay, other workers can come to Canada, it's hard to see how much more can be done right now in the immediate to help these people.
And I think it's also important to sit for a while with the power dynamics at play here, because like these workers often can't complain because they're not protected, and could they just be sent back to Mexico, could just be sent back to wherever they came from. There's an inherent imbalance in that. The Migrant Workers Alliance, which is an advocacy organization that put out a really big report that said workers are saying that they are facing increased intimidation and surveillance from their employers. And these intimidation tactics are coming apparently under the guise of COVID-19 protocols. So some farms have hired private security guards and they posted them at bunkhouses. This is according to the report. And those security guards' job is to tell the temporary foreign workers that if they don't follow the employer's orders, then they'll be turned over to the police. This is your food and my food. This is right now what is kind of involved in meeting the demands of the grocery stores that they're stocked so that we can go there and find what we're looking for. And I think most of us had no idea that that's what goes into it sometimes. When other workers have safety issues in their occupations, there are other avenues you can refer to. You can, I don't know, maybe go to union, for example. Mm-hmm. Temporary foreign workers have very few advocacy options that are available to them. And I guess related to that power imbalance, we're seeing some of these horror stories. Some workers are – you mentioned the federal government gave farms money, about $50 million, so they could pay workers not to work and be in quarantine for 2 weeks once they arrived. There are some reports of workers not being paid for that period of time. They don't have enough PPE. There was a Globe report that had a story where one worker had a nosebleed and chest pains. Mm-hmm. He literally bled on the vegetables he was tending to, and the supervisors refused to take him home until the end of his shift. We heard Doug Ford recently acknowledge that there's a fear there of being tested, and he was begging the workers to get tested. But those workers are afraid of being sent back without their work or their wages if they test positive. So their lack of access to power is literally, you know, putting these workers in more danger.
Yeah, because their right to work here is connected to the job. And so there is, as many advocates have pointed out, that, and as you did, that really serious power imbalance. And so it leads people to wonder, is the long-term fix something else? And there was a quote that I noticed from Justin Trudeau. In fact, he sort of repeated it about a week ago too. But back in September, he talked about the best path forward to ensuring the temporary foreign workers are okay is a pathway to citizenship. And that is what advocates say as well, that some sort of pathway to permanent residency would allow the workers to then take away the part of the deportation if you complain about your working conditions so that they would be safe. And so the government has started a pilot project for 3 years in some of these industries to create that pathway for workers, assuming then that if you know that you're not going to get deported because you have a right to be in the country, then you are also able to make a complaint against your employer and not be worried about the rest of it, which I think long term probably makes some sense. And certainly mm-hmm. the government seems open to it. But I don't know what it does short term. Like, what does it do right now to keep people safe right now?
Yeah, it seems like this particular situation is it's just too far gone. You mentioned that the federal government has a responsibility to do inspections of these accommodations, but they switch to virtual inspections. Well, the provinces are supposed to be responsible for occupational health and safety, but they don't inspect the accommodations. But local health units are supposed to go in and inspect them, but they do it before workers arrive. And obviously, you know, it seems like those accommodations look very different when there's so many people inside of them than when they're empty. It's like every level of government has so far failed temporary foreign workers.
Bro, that's the sound of you! Having a drink
today
on a patio.
Right after this recording, boom, I'm going to a patio. Today, this very day.
I still haven't gone. So maybe it's just the novelty of it. All right. It also means it's last call. Last week, we asked about the government's upcoming fiscal snapshot. And we asked you, is it important to you to see the government lay out a clear picture of where the country is at economically right now? I'm so interested in the responses.
Me too. We heard from a few people. One person tweeted, TBH, that's to be honest, I feel like I know we're in dire straits financially. A budget would be useful knowledge, but I'm not rushing it. And then they added that grimacing, pained smile emoji, and I'm totally there with you. And another person said, it matters to me that the government lay out the fiscal situation we are in because the conversation has started about how we will pay for it. And I appreciate that they added, no, I am not the outside the Ottawa bubble.
Word. I'm with you in that bubble.
Yeah, of course.
Whether you're inside or outside, like El Amin, this week we want to know, have the Prime Minister's daily briefings been useful to you throughout the pandemic? They have been for me. It's like 2 hours of TV for me every day. Guaranteed.
Well, they've been useful for me because I get to see your face on TV every day.
Oh, sucking up is good. Tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Please throw in the hashtag Party Lines and let us know what you think.
And that is it for Party Lines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamin Abdul Mahmoud, Chief Patio Correspondent and Editor of News Curation for BuzzFeed News. Let me do it. Just let me do it.
Have fun.
Thank you.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.